And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of January 4th, 2022. Yeah, I got that right, believe it or not, 2022. Today, we're joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm doing well, and I cannot wait for a fascinating panel discussion on the Adam McKay's movie Don't Look Up, where we talk about the highs, the lows, and all the things in between.
Recently, there has been a movie released that has caused quite a stir in climate circles. That movie, in case you haven't heard of it, is called Don't Look Up. It's by Leonardo DiCaprio, and Jennifer Lawrence. It's a satirical take on a lot of things. Because it has caused such a splash in climate circles, we have endeavored to bring together an august panel of movie critics and climate hawks all in one place to discuss this movie. I want to introduce them, and then we're going to talk about the movie. But let me just say, dear listener, we are not going, there may be spoilers in our conversation. So if you really want to preserve your innocence about this movie and see it uncontaminated by our crazy take on it, my advice is to drop out now and come back in a week after you've seen it. But I certainly urge you to see it. So I'm going to give you five count to shut down your iPhone, and then we will continue. All right. So anyway, we're back. We're legal now. So the next guest we have with us is an old friend of the show. You may remember him, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Thanks so much. Doing well. Great to speak to you again.
That's great. D.R. Tucker has been with us for years, is a media maven, I think is what I used to call you. You used to know everything about climate comms and be very astutely aware of that. We're also joined by the executive director of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network, Ms. Sarah Dooling. How are you doing, Sarah?
I'm doing very well. So glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you. It's wonderful to have you. And finally, Mariah, can you introduce our last guest?
Yes. So this is my father, as well as my co-author for my book, Protecting the Planet from Conservation to Climate Change. And Bud Titlow is his name. He's also a prolific photographer and has written several other books that have done well. And is a former wetland scientist, retired wetland scientist.
So welcome, Bud. So let's get down to brass tacks here. This is, as I say, this is a new record for the Climate Minute. We have five guests on at once. We'll do our best to keep everything clear. But let's just talk about this movie for a minute. I've got my iPad in front of me, and I'm going to Google Don't Look Up and get the short and what Google says this movie is about. Okay, here's what the movie Google says. Don't Look Up is basically a show that says two low-level astronomers must go on a giant meteor tour to warn mankind of an approaching comet that will destroy planet Earth. Right, that's about as succinct a statement of what this movie is about as I can possibly imagine. Right, that really, but the story essentially is that there are these two scientists. They're working hard. They discover, as they say, this huge meteor that's going to hit Earth in 6 months. They go to the White House. They get blown off by the White House because it's not politically convenient to talk about this six-month deadline until finally it becomes politically convenient to talk about the incoming comet, in which they launch from Earth a special mission to go and deflect the asteroid. And then as that mission launches, the big tech guys show up and say, oh my God, look, there's $140 trillion worth of lithium on that thing. We can find a clever way to save all that money with only a few small splashes in the Pacific, which this all plays out under the increasing desperation of the climate scientists who are up and down and upset. And again, since we're past the spoiler alert, it does not end happily for the Earth, as you might say. Kind of a depressing movie. There were so many little issues in this, from the female scientist that is disrespected and not defended on national TV and made the scapegoat. There's the white male scientist who gets to have the rant on TV. There's the big tech people promising a high-tech solution if we can just send the bash cell phone company things out there. There's this idea that we have the Meryl Streep plays a Trump-like president of the United States. Before we even get a female president, we're already trashing a female president, right? We have absurd TV coverage. And so anyway, and we have just, I'm going to come back to this. The Pentagon general charges the scientist $10 for the potato chips. And she spends the rest of the movie trying to figure out why, right? So you guys we have to answer that question. And is it some metaphor that I'm missing? Anyway, the media critics hate this movie because they say it's too slapdash and too broad. But one question I hope we can address is whether or not the craft of the movie or the point of the movie are two separate things that we ought to consider. And there you go. So that's my introduction, dear listener, to what the movie is. What we're going to do is go around and hear from each of our guests, their take, what they thought about it, and then we'll have an open discussion. Right? Everyone's nodding. That's a good thing all the way around. We're going to start with Bud Titlow. Go.
Oh, gosh. Can everybody hear me? I got to go first with all you guys. I was really anxious to see this movie. As a matter of fact, we went the first night it opened here in San Diego. I kind of knew what it was going to entail, especially with DiCaprio as the lead actor. And I know that he actually was not credited with really crafting the movie. But I just could see him all through this movie because he's tried so many different things to alert the public to what's going on with climate change and the immediacy and urgency of climate change. And he's produced at least three movies, scientific type, you know, real information, fact-based for PBS type movies. And all the people that have been in climate change for say 30 years, from McKibben to Hansen to, DiCaprio and Ruffalo, they're all very frustrated. Mariah and I know this firsthand. It's just I felt like he was trying to make a point by going kind of a totally different route, by making a blockbuster, Hollywood blockbuster movie that had all the elements that people usually flock to the theaters to see the big action thriller stuff, which I can't stand, quite frankly. But this one... And like Ted said, I think just a few minutes ago, or mentioned to us at the start, it really is chock full of, and I guess it's hard to say it's humorous, but I would say it's sad humor. It's sad satire, if you will, because it is funny. I laughed a lot, and but it's so true. I thought it was well done. I don't think it's going to change the minds of anybody that's a total denier or a fence-sitting denier, quite frankly, and I really don't know what will. And I think I'm kind of on the same wavelength with DiCaprio in that regard. So I'll leave it at that and hear what anybody else has to say.
Okay. Well, that's the fickle finger of fate is pointing at you, DR. What was your take on the movie? And then we're going to go ahead.
Well, I've seen it twice now. And I mentioned to a friend that years ago, Roger Ebert wrote a review in the Chicago Sun-Times of a movie with Scarlett Johansson called Ghost World. And the review started, "I wanted to hug this movie." And that's my exact same reaction. In terms of how precisely it nailed public scorn of science, governmental scorn of science, media scorn of science, which we've talked about in terms with our friend Betsy Rosenberg for years, in terms of how accurately it nailed the human condition, it in terms of a political satire, you know, I haven't seen Dr. Strangelove, but I've seen Network, I've seen The Candidate, I've seen Bulworth, I've seen Wag the Dog. It's the granddaddy of them all. And I thought in terms of a moral statement of conscience, of anger and of outrage towards, you know, what the status quo is, it went beyond even other comparisons to other movies. I was mentioning to a friend, to me, this is this generation's version of Marvin Gaye's What's Going On. This is a profound statement. And I know Adam McKay is the director, is you know, he's got his share of scorn in media film critic circles. But to me, I think, you know, Bud mentioned it may not change the minds of people who are already scornful of science. But in terms of what I think it's intended to do, which is to galvanize and to wake people up and to shock the conscience of people who see it, I absolutely think it is going to have the same impact as the 1983 film The Day After did. I recognize the movie's not for everybody's taste, and I do have friends who did find it depressing. And my argument is that it is much like The Day After. If you remember that movie from the 80s, it is necessarily depressing to shock the conscience, to make people realize what happens when we don't act, and to make people realize that, as Martin Luther King, I believe, said, there is such a thing as being too late. And I think that the so-called Last Supper conclusion of the film, that hammers away the point that there is such a thing as being too late.
Last Supper, yes, the Last Supper scene. Oh my God, I hadn't even thought of that. But okay, I'm coming back to you on that one. So, Mariah, you're next on the hit list here. Tell me, what was your take on this movie? What did you think?
So, you know, I'm probably in a similar place of wanting to hug the movie in some regard. I love that quote, Dr. I thought it was ridiculous and entertaining and far too close to reality, sort of like what, you know, Bud and DR have said. I hope that it's getting people to talk, and maybe I know that Bud said it's not necessarily, might not change sort of the on the fence centers and so on and so forth. And I agree with that, but maybe it will open it up to a population who's not usually talking about these things, not usually paying attention to these things. You know, you think in the movie how the big topic on the show is it wasn't Ariana Grande, it was who was the character she played, Riley Bina. Mm-hmm. Who she was dating, and if she had, you know, broken up with DJ Crude or whatever his name was. And DJ Cello, right? DJ Cello. And you know, maybe this is getting people who maybe are thinking about that to kind of switch in the same way that they did in the movie. Who knows, right? That's a sort of my secret hope. But at the very least, it did, you know, it skewered so many people that are standing in the way of climate action and maybe needed a good thorough skewering in a public place. And I appreciate it for that. Also, I think this was, you know, Adam McKay he created it from this place of frustration over the lack of action and disdain for climate science, and wanted to do something. And this was a way he could use his talents to address the problem, which is something that I think we all should be doing. We should look at our talents and figure out how can we use our skill set towards something to you know, get people moving on climate action. So in that regard, I thought it was it was very, very compelling.
Okay. Good. And finally, last, but you know, by no means least, Sarah, what was your take on the movie?
Well, I think I find it so interesting. The other panelists on the call today, their perceptions of the movie, wanting to hug the movie and valuing it for potentially opening up conversations. For me, the movie just shut the conversation down. And I watched it with my spouse, my husband, not in our home. So we weren't in a place that was familiar to us. We were in somebody else's home. And halfway through the movie, I looked at him and I said, what is this? It wasn't for me. I didn't experience it as a true satire. I experienced it as a pit of unending cynicism with no way out, especially the Last Supper scene. And that, quite frankly, left me feeling, why did I waste my time? I could have been reading something or out walking. And it's very interesting the way that the movie had a very many plots happening. Yes, there is the overarching plot, but there are many different narrative threads. It attempted to be funny, but I think Jennifer Lawrence's character, I perceived her character as completely, as you opened up the conversation tonight, Ted, completely ignored and disregarded. And that hit a little close to home on, you know, in certain periods of my life. So I felt as if the representations of reality were so harsh and so biting that there was, in fact, for me, no real sense of comic relief and no seriousness behind the attempt to be satirical, right? Because I think really good satires are very serious. And I'm, you know, it'd be great, you know, gosh, wouldn't it be fun to get McKay on here and say, what happens when you create from a place of utter frustration? I mean, did that somehow, for me, perhaps inadvertently kill the movie?
Wow. Okay. So I guess we have sides. We'll choose up. Let's do this. Let me just comment. We'll go around again. Okay. After we've heard, I mean, I think that I take the movie as a satire. DR, I was going to say, I'm more familiar with Dr. Strangelove. That was more in my formative time, right? So for me, this is a Strangelove. And I think that the impact of Strangelove didn't change anybody's mind in 1963, right? But over time, that seeps in. It's a framing that somebody who watches that, you know, who's 10 years old, is going to grow up with that as the frame of, through which they see the issue, right? Which is the cynicism behind it. I think that I would comment, no one has distinctly made the connection that a meteor is not climate change, right? Mm-hmm. But for all of us, it's so obvious. Maybe isn't, because I've seen people compare it to COVID or various other things, right? We're clearly making this climate connection because we know the background. Sarah, I was going to ask you, I mean, if you had felt disrespected in your previous scientific endeavors, was it not an exoneration that in the movie they clearly portrayed this rejection and say, yeah, that happened? I mean, I somehow validation maybe is the right word, as opposed to do you think that this was an oversight on the part of the authors, right? And they too engaged in rejecting, you know, because there was something, you know, blame Kate, and it was, you know, Comet Diabaski or something, like, right, we got to stop Diabaski. Somehow she took the hit for it. Was that conscious, you think, on the part of McKay, or did you think it was unconscious, in which case it would be hurtful?
Oh, I don't want to speculate about McKay's motives or intentions here, but I do think, you know, what is the role of this kind of movie? Mariah said it doesn't, she doesn't think necessarily that it's going to motivate people to take direct action. I tend to agree. What am I trying to say here? I don't feel like I need validation for things that have happened, right? So from this movie, what I went into this movie expecting, and so maybe this is me setting myself up for disappointment, was a story that transformed how scientists potentially constrain themselves, right? They're not typically trained to be public relations people or to work with the media. They are trained to talk in jargon. They're not necessarily trained to think about, well, Michael Mann, who I guess is loosely what the film is based on, the lead scientific character, Dr. Michael mm-hmm. Mann, somebody I really respect and admire his work. But what I was really hoping for was a broadening of what scientists considered their job, considered their work, considered their purview. And what I saw in the movie was what I see now, you know, a media that is either too afraid to be really blunt and to the point and aggressive on climate messaging, or media that are so politically correct that things aren't, that a balanced story is what you get, which is something that MCAN has encountered, you know, in media coverage of the Peabody campaign.
Right.
So maybe I was going into this movie looking for a little bit more fantasy and what could be possible, as opposed to using a mirror around media inadequacy and bad messaging, if you will, and scientists, you know, falling in bed with media in whatever way.
Literally or figuratively, yeah.
Right. And by the way, I thought Kate Blanchett did a fantastic job. I thought she was the best of all of them. She just nailed that media person. And she had, of all the characters, I think Kate Blanchett presented some complexities. And the other characters I thought were very flat. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so maybe I set myself up for disappointment.
I guess, I mean, that's part of the thing I've seen is that, I mean, it's only a movie, right? You can only, I mean, it can't solve every problem at once, and that it does what it does. And let me shift gears a little bit. I got one, Mariah, what do you got?
Well, this is Mariah. Just to respond to those points there, I think they're great points, and definitely something that I hadn't thought about. So it's good to kind of look at it from that viewpoint. I will say about, you know, I thought there were two characters, Dr. Teddy Oglethorpe and Kate DiBiase, who, in my view, sort of stayed true to the mission. They didn't get lost in the melee of media frenzy and celebrityism. And for the whole story, those two characters in particular were very focused on, this is a problem, and we need to do something about it. And it's incredibly urgent. And we're not going to sugarcoat it or be fluffy about it, because it matters. And so I felt that in a little way, you know, again, I can't speak to what Adam McKay's intentions were, but he honored those two characters for their commitment to science in a way that I think lifted them up. And I appreciated that little piece of honoring the female scientist and, you know, Teddy as the head of, I forget what the...
Interplanetary Defense Force or something, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. You know, so I liked that kind of the way that those two characters were held so nicely. You know, I also sort of, let's see, well, I'll leave it at that. I had a different train of thought I was going to go down, so I'll just leave it at that.
I have a question for Bud. My wife and I have seen the movie twice now, and each time we've discussed what is essentially these little inserts of nature photography of the the hippopotamus and the fish and the baby, which somehow, I mean, I'm interested in everyone's take on, you know, why was so affecting, right? Because it sort of widened the lens to say, oh yeah, there's a lot at stake here that you have no dream about. I mean, how did you react to that as a nature photographer?
Yeah, I appreciated that, Ted. I thought it was really an effective way to go. I wish they'd done more of it, more with it, quite frankly, instead of just interspersing quick shots here and there throughout the story. They could have made that really effective, much more so than they did. I would have liked, that was one thing I would definitely like to have seen done better in the movie. But I like the idea that they at least tried some of that. I'm not sure that it really came off to people that aren't nature thinkers.
Sarah.
But it was a good idea, I think. I wish they'd done more.
I think Bud is onto something here. When those shots first appeared, I thought, wow, these are our non-human neighbors that are going to be lost. And then I started thinking about, but there are none of those shots, Bud, if you watch the movie, are urban, right? They are all this nature that's away from the city, away from the capital. They're in these nature preserves or in these places far away from the U.S. even. So I just thought it was kind of an interesting, and again, this disjointed, fragmented attempt to kind of lay out a patchwork of a story that says, over here, well, I think there was a macaw, there are all these interesting critters, but that they weren't necessarily tied to the fabric of the story in a way that grounded us all in the same spot. But
yeah, I just finished a book that kind of weaves the story of climate change and protection of biodiversity that we still have remaining into being the two primary goals of what the book is trying to accomplish at the end. And I kind of threw that in, really, the biodiversity part, the climate change and the biodiversity as our two major environmental crises that we currently, that I think are the greatest environmental crises we've ever faced. And I kind of attribute that to E.O. Wilson and my respect and interest in him. And also, especially since he just passed away. So I would have liked to have seen a lot more done with that. I guess I understand what you're saying. It just seemed to come out of left field too much. And it could have been such a strong, relevant part of the movie.
Is it possible, do you think, that maybe the connection is there's so many species and there's so many vulnerable populations, both species and people, who are at the whim of those in power? And maybe the connection there is, look at everything that gets affected because of the willy-nilly decisions of people, you know, who have ulterior motives in protecting everything that's vulnerable.
Yeah, you got it right on the nose, Mariah. That's just the whole idea, John Muir. Everything in the world is interconnected. We're interconnected with all the rest of the species in the world, and our destiny is not to have dominion over those species. Our destiny is to live with and preserve those species to the extent that we can possibly do it. We still have that dominion idea in too many people's heads, unfortunately, that's what the other species on Earth are for, dominion by humans. That's absolute BS. Anyway, sorry.
No. I got a question for DR. Let me ask this. DR, you've thought a lot about media coverage, and I know for a fact that what was your take on this sort of, you know, the whole media thing with the daily rip, right? The show in the morning and just the mindless banter. And that's all where did you come down on that?
I thought it was a brilliant bit of casting to have Ariana Grande play sort of the pop star who becomes the focal point of the discussion as opposed to the actual scientists, because it references the real life media frenzy when Ariana Grande broke up with Pete Davidson and how that got a hell of a lot more coverage. Because if I recall correctly, wasn't that around the time that there was a big climate assessment report that the Trump administration leaked around Thanksgiving of 2018?
Oh, yeah, didn't
get 1/50th of the coverage of Ariana Grande breaking up with Pete Davidson, if I have my timeline correctly. so they've and also there was that great scene where when they're at the sort of what's obviously the New York Times, and obviously satirizing the New York Times is, you know, sort of come see, come saw coverage and bringing on deniers on their op-ed page and that sort of thing, where they do a measurement of the of how stories are trending. And there's that discussion about how the story about the comet hitting is not trending at all and causing DiCaprio and Lawrence's characters to freak out, and having that great scene of Jennifer Lawrence's character saying, "You're all going to die, and you're all going to die." Yeah. It was just, and it goes back to a point that Sarah made, and two points that she made that I agreed with, but in a different way. When she talks about the cynicism that sort of permeates the movie, I realize, as she said that, I think the cynicism didn't bother me personally, because I think after all the years and years I've been listening to Steely Dan, cynicism doesn't bother me as much. But in terms of the point of the movie, and it struck me as the movie is on some level sort of a primal screen. And maybe the scenes of nature that's interspersed, that's also sort of McKay's primal scream and saying, look what the hell we're doing. We're not paying attention. Meryl Streep, you know, it's also interesting that Meryl Streep is being cast, because remember, the right wing used to go after Meryl Streep of media. The right wing used to go after Meryl Streep because she used to speak out against, you know, Alar, if you remember the chemical that used to spray on apples. And she testified in Congress and said, what are we doing to our children? And people like Rush Limbaugh would ridicule her for saying that. And in fact, myself, the whole movie is saying on some level, what are we doing to our children? The cynicism of the movie is if you think about it, and I was watching this, especially the second time I watched it, I thought about it from the perspective of Adam's trying to reflect the view of Greta Thunberg and her generation. And that generation has a right to be furious. The rant that both Lawrence and DiCaprio go on the Daily Rip show, that does reflect what McKay's thinking. People have a right to be furious. And at the end, going back to the Last Supper scene where DiCaprio says, you know, we really did have everything, did we? We really did have everything, and by implication, threw it all away. One has a right to be both cynical and angry over the fact that is occurring. So I agree with Sarah's points, but I think the cynicism and the anger, and you know, I've had people I know feel that they call the movie nihilistic. You can, from a certain perspective, you can understand a bit of nihilism when you've had what 34 years now since Jim Hansen went to Congress urging them to do something, and Congress didn't look up. Congress is still not looking up. Look at Joe Manchin. Joe Manchin's looking down. So can you blame Adam McKay and the creators for being cynical and nihilistic and filled with rage when you look at what's going on? I don't blame them at all.
Sarah's hand is so far up, it's off the screen. Sarah, what do you got?
Yeah, your comments reminded me of another frustration I had with the movie. Mm-hmm. And, you know, why are we inferring from the movie, which is about a comet, that it's about climate change? Why did McKay decide that we can't, that this movie could not directly engage the cynicism of climate change? Why? I'm really curious what people think about that.
Mariah's got her hand up. Oh, I'm sorry, then DR. Mariah, then DR.
So I did listen to a question and answer with McKay, where he said that he was in the middle of making the movie Vice. And I guess that was right around with Dick Cheney, which, I mean, you know, I think Dick Cheney was also did some good things for climate change in some sense, but right when he was undermining a lot of action on climate change, just as the IPCC report was coming out. And I think he said David Wallace Wells' book, Uninhabitable Earth, controversial as it may be, was also coming out, and that, you know, Adam McKay said he lost sleep for three nights over just the sort of deep trauma that this was kind of bringing to him. And then he was talking to his longtime journalist friend, David Serono, who said, it's like an asteroid is about to hit Earth and nobody cares. And that's when he said, and he'd been trying to figure out how he wanted to do a climate change movie and he couldn't figure out the right analogy. And when David Serono said that, he said, that's it. It is like an asteroid is barreling towards us and nobody wants to do anything about it. And so, I mean, I think to your point, Sarah, it would be nice if can't he just say it's about climate change, right? But maybe the whole point is that we won't get it if it's about climate change. It's too nuanced. It's not, the timeline is too long, or, the other movies that have tried to do it haven't succeeded. And so he wanted something that was more in your face, perhaps. I don't know.
DR.
I was thinking also, and I also I'm also familiar with that interview that McKay did. So thanks for highlighting that. I was also wondering if McKay on some level figured that if he said it directly, and tried to get financing, they would say to him, they already did The Day After Tomorrow. We don't need to do that again. That sort of thing. So he had to come up with an analogy. But I just think back to make another point about the primal scream nature of the film, and the comparison I made to Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, which was also just this sort of a boiling point of anger against the Vietnam War. And if you think about it, One of the criticisms a friend of mine had is that the movie suggests that people who would call for action would be ignored. And the point I wanted to make, and we had a long discussion, but I never got around to make the point that there is a historical precedent for people calling for action and calling for change and they're being ignored besides climate. Look at the millions of people around the world in 2002 and 2003 who demanded that the United States not invade Iraq, and they were all blown off. The politicians in this country looked down. They didn't look up. So again, you can understand the cynicism, and to tie it back to Marvin Gaye, if you look at that level of cynicism, it does kind of make you want to holler, doesn't it?
Well,
go
ahead, Sarah.
It does make me want to holler. And I wish, I wish the holler was kind of an expression, had some resolution to it. Right. The Last Supper scene is dreadful. It's awful. And I just thought, what's going on here? And maybe because I'm so immersed in advocacy, as a way of trying to focus this organization's time and energy on transforming power in all of its iterations, right, towards a better world, that the cynicism, I think, came out of what struck me as very conventional, traditional, stereotypical representations of what the different people did in the movie. The scientists were very conventional. Where were the vulnerable people in that movie? Where were they? None of the main characters, from my take, were from a frontline community or environmental. I mean, it's just very, in a way, it just struck me as a very conventional, deeply cynical representation of these of scientists, of media saturated, distracted, corrupt government officials. I don't know, and I just felt like there wasn't. I didn't experience any room for vitality other than these, every now and again, these snapshots of nature, intact, beautiful shots of birds and insects and reptiles and cats. So I don't know. I'm curious what you think about that, DR, like this very conventional representation of roles and disciplines.
Again, there's a part of me that thinks that had there been more of a focus on frontline communities, had there been more of a focus on the people who would be the most injured by the threat, I start wondering, would there have been an issue getting the movie financed if McKay had introduced those ideas? I mean, it's when people are coming down on McKay, even for the Timothy Chalamet character, who's trying to introduce ideas of faith and science that Catherine Hayhoe discusses, when even that is something that gets heat from McKay, introducing even more ideas like that, I just wonder, I imagine it must have been, even with DiCaprio on board, even with all the stars on board, I imagine it must have been a burden and a half trying to get financing for this. And I think even if McKay had tried to introduce those ideas, it would have been a virtually impossible task to get any financing, even with DiCaprio. Look at the history of movies, even with stars attached, that have difficulty getting financing or distribution. I remember 20 years ago, Tom Hanks and My Big Fat Greek Wedding could barely get, you know, any kind of backing. So something tells me that McKay had to sort of tailor things in such a way just to get basic financing to tell the shall we say, narrowly tailored story they did tell.
Mariah.
Yeah. So from a climate communication sort of, some of the research that I come up on is that when people feel like they're being persuaded or they're being preached to with a certain message, it can alienate them right off the get-go. And so maybe there was some intentionality in choosing something that could be metaphorical for climate change without being climate change, because it would invite people in who maybe would not go see a climate change movie, as sort of as DR is saying, right, that it might not get the funding. And you might also not, there's a section of the population who might never go see it because they're not going to go see a climate change movie, right? So, but they'll go see a movie about a meteor hitting the Earth. So that might have been, you know, helping to kind of buoy the attendance. I also, you know, back to your point, Sarah, about how it ended in this, I mean, it ended in this really awful way, but there was a moment of hope in the movie where, you know, Meryl Streep as President Orlean had made the right decision and everyone was aligned and it was this joyful, like, we're going to, you know, shoot this comet down, we're going to destroy it. There was this moment where the right path was being taken. And I wonder if that is sort of this call to arms. We're at this inflection point now. Don't make the same mistake they made in the movie by moving toward profit. No, stick to the course, save the humanity so that you have a chance for a future. You know, let this be sort of the lesson that the path we don't take.
If I could just, in parallel, you talked about a moment of joy in the movie where everyone is aligned. My wife, who's very smart and a theater person, was pointing out that on the ride to the Last Supper, the Timothée Chalamet, that's how you pronounce it, Yule, right? He proposes marriage, Chalamet. Right? In this end of the world scenario, right? Mm-hmm. So this is sort of moment of you know, this guy is still thinking life is going to be good, which, you know, whether better or not. Sorry, did you have a response? Two directions. We sort of touched on one of, you know, the role that climate activists play in this. They're sort of pushed to the bottom. They're not really played out. But one of the big things that comes through the movie is the faith in technology to be a sort of a single saving thing, right? And if you remember the cellular phone company, who we don't mention by name, right? But I mean that in the sort of autistic idiot savant who's running it, right? But I mean, it's sold as a good thing, right? We're going to end world hunger. We're going to get all these minerals. Everyone's going to have a cell phone. We're going to go do this technical thing, which ultimately fails. I mean, is there a story to tell around that, or a reaction to that as what is in the movie, as opposed to it? And I think the problem with the comet as a metaphor for climate change is that it doesn't admit of as many sort of holistic solutions that you might think about, other than sending these little spider robots out to the meteor to collide with each other and stuff. So who's got it? Who wants to say? Can anybody? DR, you had your hand up first. I feel like I'm playing, what was the game, the high school game, the quiz game where you have to bang the button to answer the question? A college bowl, that's right. Anyway, DR, you had your hand up.
The reason why there was some criticism towards that angle with the Mark Rylance character figuring he could exploit the comet for profit. What I loved about it is that, and I mentioned this to another friend of mine, That's the first time in a movie that I can recall seeing a demonstration of the Naomi Klein shock doctrine. Because here you have profiting from disaster, and in some cases letting a disaster, trying to let a disaster happen so you can make one character says something like $410 trillion worth of wealth from it. And I thought, I have never, I cannot recall any artistic venture that so perfectly illustrated what the shock doctrine is. And they did it perfectly. It was amazing. That's one of the reasons I fell in love with this movie.
You wanted to hug it.
Yeah.
Now, this is Sarah. I think DR's right on the money there. That was a very striking moment in the movie. And at the same time, I think the metaphor of the comet and the command and control response to that threat does not necessarily translate into holistic, small scale, decentralized visions of our future energy system as a specific response to climate change. And so that's where I thought, why is this movie about a comet as opposed to climate change? And I appreciate all the comments around the financing struggles that McKay may have come up against to make it a more explicit climate change movie. But, you know, the command and control, it was response to the threat was so old white man school, old US government response. That, and I think that was probably very intentional. You know, all of the global partners just kind of went away in the movie. And so I felt as if this movie, this conversation has helped me articulate this more precisely. Like, this movie does not deal in diversities. Like, you know, it doesn't deal in, what am I trying to say? Creativity. It doesn't deal in kind of thinking about things slightly different from reality. It's such a mirror. And so this conversation has helped me realize, you know, I get frustrated by looking at mirrors that hold up things that I still continue to struggle with. And so I think if this movie does, like Mariah is saying, invite people to see it that wouldn't go see a climate change movie, and those folks have conversations, that's wonderful. And, you know, if folks, you know, like DR's comment saying, oh, this is the first time Naomi Klein's ideas about the shock doctrine are in a blockbuster movie, that's fantastic. And so maybe these are the small moments where McKay is kind of not as angry, you know, he's sort of presenting something that's a little less infuriating to him.
I would say he's planting the seeds of a cultural change, right? I mean, I don't think anyone's going to walk out of that movie and say, oh, I've changed my mind completely. But this stuff grows and it adds to a sort of a set of work that begins to define climate change culturally, which I think is where we have to go, right? In the response to climate change, at least people become aware of it. I mean, from my perspective, it's a movie that takes a hack at a very big problem, and it may not be perfect, but it's taken a swing. It's in the game, and I think that.
You know what? I would love to hear from somebody who does not necessarily engage in climate activism, but who has gone to the movie, and I would just like to hear what they take away from the movie. You know, it's a very, I think again, it's such a narrowly, how did you say that, DR? Narrowly scripted or narrowly presented movie that, you know, I have a lot of friends, you know, that are climate communications experts, and they're like, oh my God, Sarah, this movie is just, it's over the top in its inability to effectively communicate with urgency and precision about the threat of the comet. And the media is, the big culprit in that communication strategy of misinformation, which is kind of what MCAN deals with on a different level with other things. But I don't know. I would just like to hear how this movie is received by folks that are really interested in the comet and not in climate.
I saw a tweet from someone who said, who like completely missed the point of the movie and say, this is a stupid movie about a comet. Right? It didn't work for me. I didn't like it very much because it was, you know, two final questions. Did you guys stay through the credits? Oh, yes. Number one, what do you think of the 22,000 years in the future scene? What do you make of that? And then did you stay to the bitter end?
Yes.
Okay. Well, anyway, so who wants to talk about the Bronte arc? DR, you go.
it's a great scene, basically showing, you know, the folly of human arrogance, basically the idea that you know, even 22,000 years in the future, humankind thinks it can conquer nature, and ultimately nature conquers humankind. And it was the brilliance of that scene, and the brilliance of the very last scene in which the Jonah Hill character can, you know, seemingly the last person on Earth can only think of trying to embrace social media.
Like and subscribe.
It's just the brilliant cynicism, if you will, or just there's. I keep going back and I keep rolling back to that Last Supper scene, and I just think about the brilliant heartbreak of the scene. I was thinking, racking my brain, when's the last time I've seen a scene that knocked me out emotionally like that? And I can think of two scenes. Number one, if you remember the movie Terms of Endearment, the scene where Deborah Winger's character can't pay her grocery bill, and just how harrowing that scene was because you just imagine being in that position. And number two, as odd as this is a comparison, but in terms of love juxtaposed with loss, I actually thought of the last scene in E.T., The Extraterrestrial, and how it just sort of, you know, ripped my, there's something about that scene, that Last Supper scene, that just, it knocks you down. And it is just, it's like the term beautiful disaster comes to my mind. How at the end, at the very end, people embrace love and faith and you know, it's, you know, and just anything positive and family, right at the termination point of life. And it's just, it is an unforgettable scene. I've said it before. I hope Madam McKay at least wins best original screenplay, because that just, I've run out of words to describe how just phenomenal, in my view, that scene is. And just in terms of the beauty and the humor and the heartbreak, it is just, I mean, good Shakespeare couldn't come up with this stuff. It just knocked me out.
Oh my God, Sarah.
So that's fascinating to me, DR, because I thought the Last Supper scene was so fragile. It was very, the relationships at that table were so tenuous, mm-hmm. right? So DiCaprio's character, he has just come back and connected with his spouse. Jennifer Lawrence's character and the burnt out evangelical character, they are just kind of navigating, getting to know each other. So it's this very fragile, tenuous, deeply, I thought, alienated dinner in the context of, you know, all of those people fully realizing. There was the activist, the former planetary director.
Teddy Oglethorpe.
Yes. He was at the table. And it just felt like, here we are. We are the people that, for better or for worse, know each other right now. Mm-hmm. And this is what, and this is kind of, I took it more as kind of an anthropological perspective. Like this was the this is the ritual of people saying goodbye. And so I thought it was less about love and faith and family and more about a deeply alienated ritual with very fragile relationships.
I agree for a different reason. Literally, as you said that, it just hit me another comparison. And literally, as you said that about fragility, when you said the word fragile, I mentioned the Steely Dan comparison, and the thought came to my head that you're right, and I agree with you for a different reason. It reminded me, as you said it, and I thought about that scene again, it reminded me of this great Steely Dan song called King of the World, which is about a guy who seems to be the last person on Earth. He suffered after a nuclear war. He's suffering from radiation poisoning. He thinks he's about to die, and he's on a ham radio trying to find somebody. He's so emotionally fragile. He's trying to find somebody to speak to before he dies of radiation poisoning. And I thought, and think about, you know, these characters are about to die from a different form of poisoning, but at least they are fragile, but at least they have something to hold on to as the darkness falls in their lives. You're so right. I mean, wow. It's just, I told you Shakespeare couldn't come up with this stuff.
On a separate note, I thought it was very strange that at that very profound Last Supper, they were talking about the difference between store-bought pie and homemade apple pie. And I was like, what is that?
That's the alienation.
That was a very sort of...
How do we talk about this moment? Right? What I would have liked to have heard. How do we, like if us five were at a table, you know, fully with the full knowledge that this is it, you know, at you know, 10:04, it's done. You're like, what would we talk about?
I think that their reaction in that circumstance, I would say, was they are trying to maintain their humanity in the face. They're going to play it out right to the end, right? Instead of weeping, I thought the Kate Diabaski character, you know, she broke down several times. I mean, you'd all be in tears. I mean, you know, what's the point, right? But I mean, if you're going to live, you're going to try and live as normally as you can for as long as you can. Don't we all want to do that, right? We're all at the Last Supper table, right? And so everyone wants to maintain themselves and keep marching. Go ahead, Sarah.
I don't know because, you know, a climate changed world is such a radically changed set of interconnected systems and people and communities. It calls for a different way of being. I really believe this. It calls for a different kind of courage. It calls for, I think, scientists having the chutzpah to figure out how to talk effectively to the alt-right. It calls for a broadening of advocacy so that when we talk about climate change, we're actually talking about a better future for everybody and not necessarily having to use it. So what I'm trying to say is that, again, I think how the characters talked to each other at the Last Supper lacked creativity in how those characters could honor what they tried to do.
I think, I mean, I hear you and I take the point. I think that I guess that is like, there's the comet has its own thing. And at the end of the, of course, since you're listening, dear listener, right? At the end, the comet hits, everybody dies, right? No surprise there, except for the people going to get eaten by the Bronto Arc. But I mean, the whole planet dies. Is that a failure of the movie? If you want to talk about climate change, is that sort of abysmal, you know, one answer, everyone dies. Is that the right way to have a satire, or does it encourage, is some part of the movie encourage action to avoid it? I see DR had his hand up first.
I don't know. Well, I just want to jump in with a quick clarification that the planet doesn't die. The people die. I think that's an important clarification because it shows in 22,000, the planet's gorgeous. There's just no
that's a different planet.
I thought that was the same. Oh, maybe it was a different planet.
They went for a Goldilocks style planet.
But I take your point.
I mean, something's going to, you know, in a few hundred million years, the cockroaches will be looking at the layer of plastic in the in their archaeological digs and talking about how the humans destroyed the planet. But I mean,
right.
So DR, is the destruction of the life, human life on the planet, is that a good way to carry the metaphor through?
I know it's not everybody's taste, and I've heard from people who hated that the Last Supper scene because of it, because they just thought it was nihilistic. But to me, it worked, because you know what it reminded me of? Another musical reference, that great line from Stevie Wonder's Living for the City: if we don't change, the world will soon be over. That so perfectly encapsulated what Stevie Wonder said in that song, and that was just a perfect visual representation of those words, I thought.
I'm going to have to sit with that, you know? I'm just going to have to sit with that, because, dear, I don't know. I still feel that the movie, for me, has more cynicism and fatality and futility. That the mirror is so harsh, and that there are and despite these little visual moments and character moments of the possibility of something else happening besides, you know, the destruction of the human species and all of our non-human neighbors, I just felt like the movie didn't take me to a place I wanted to be. I didn't see any way out. I saw no way out.
All right.
Well, and in some ways, that's the movie, your sort of criticism of the comet of the asteroid as a sort of inaccurate parallel for climate change, is because the asteroid hits and everything ends in an instant. Right. Whereas that's not what's going to happen with climate change. There will be times where we can, you know, show human resilience and human kindness by supporting each other and helping each other out and all of these different things. So, you know, the meteor doesn't leave any room for that spirit of humanity. So that the analogy falls short there as well.
Well, I think. I mean, I guess maybe I need to go watch this movie again and find a happy moment somewhere in it to buck myself up. But so we'll go around the room. You get a closing statement and a thumbs up, thumbs down. All right. Let's see. I'm going to start with Mariah. Thumbs up, thumbs down.
I still give it a thumbs up because it made me think, and it certainly has, I think, brought up a lot of conversations. Maybe, of course, you know, in some sense, yes, this is a community where it's easy to have those communications. And I agree with Sarah's point that it'd be really interesting to talk to someone who is not really sure what they think about climate change and didn't necessarily know it was a movie about climate change. I think that would be a compelling audience. I would watch this movie and will watch this movie at least one more time, as DR has already watched it twice. I will definitely be watching it twice, possibly three times, because I think there's a lot there. And certainly after this conversation, I'm curious to kind of reevaluate it with a different lens based on some of the things we've talked about.
All right, Mariah's a thumbs up. Sarah, which way is your thumb go?
My thumb is all the way down. I think, and maybe clearly this is just me, right? But I do think that cynicism is very expensive at this point. It's super expensive. And I'm not sure I wanted to, that, you know, I can't get those, whatever, 2 hours back. I could be reading White Skin, Black Fuel, this new book out that talks about fossil fascism. I don't know. So I just kind of, I give it a real thumbs down. I think it fell short of a true rigorous satire. The characters, with the exception of Kate Blanchett's character, were flat, uncomplicated, too conventional. And I think the cynicism and fragility were not given any relief through the humor, what little humor there was.
Okay. Bud, thumbs up, thumbs down.
I got to go way up.
Way up.
I think DR, you had some fabulous, genius comments there. I had never not thought of the Last Supper and the Primal Scream. Beautiful analogies. Wow. If we all think back to the asteroid has a lot of basis in climate change literature, both from Elizabeth Colbert in The Sixth Extinction and from Naomi Klein in several of her books. And I think DiCaprio, this was his primal scream. I mean, I've been trying to deal with how to actually get some action on climate change since Mariah started me thinking about climate change like 15 years ago. I think this and the whole idea of everything ending and the earth being destroyed. Well, that's, you know, what are we going to do to get people start thinking maybe we're on that kind of a course? It's going to be longer term, but the end result's going to be the same. There's not going to be any people around. We're all going to be gone. So I think DiCaprio accomplishes his objective, whether it's going to do any good or not. I don't know, but I thought the movie was good.
DR.
Before I give my thumb, I want to thank all the panelists, but I especially want to thank Sarah, because Sarah helped me refine my thinking. And you know, thank you so much for helping me to refine my thinking about this movie. Having said that, I do give it thumbs way up, because I still want to make the case for what I would call necessary cynicism, that sometimes you have to see how bleak things will get before, you know, you not that I want to quote the individual, but it is his words, before you take a look at yourself and make a change. I think as you mentioned the bleakness of the film, I thought of another reference. I mentioned to another friend of mine, another film that was bleak and cynical, and the end was bleak and cynical and quite controversial, but boy, did it make its point. Do the Right Thing. I mean, that ending was so bleak and so cynical. People were saying there were going to be riots in the theaters, but boy, did it make its point. And now 30 years later, it's still being remembered. And I will say, and I think that what McKay achieved with all the controversy, with all the divisiveness of the reviews, despite that, in terms of what he has accomplished, I think artistically, I believe he has achieved a level of cinematic immortality, the same level of cinematic immortality that Francis Ford Coppola achieved with The Godfather and Apocalypse Now. And boy, do I wish that title could be used for this film, because it's way more appropriate if you think about it.
All right.
I found out today, DR, that the original title for this movie was something like Bananas Circus.
Yeah. I would compare it to, I really think it's mentioning to the same friend, I compare it to Network. Yeah, I really think it's Network 2, because if you go back to the 70s, what Sidney Lumet and Patty Chayefsky were warning about, they were warning about the dumbing down of our politics, the dumbing down of our culture, the dumbing down of our media. And this movie, I think, shows the consequences of what happens when you dumb down the politics, dumb down the culture, and dumb down the media. You have death and you have apocalypse. Everything that's, I mean, I think Sidney Lumet and Patty Chayefsky, I think they'd be proud of what was accomplished here.
Unfortunately, that's so true.
Well, So I'm the last one. I'm going to give it a thumbs up. I kept thinking of Dr. Strangelove and using his circular slide rule. I don't know if you guys are savvy enough to remember that, but it's, I mean, that was what I think it's as I've said, a seed planted in among many that I think will shift the conversation over the long term and allow people to think differently, flawed that though it may be. And so I tell you, I am exhausted. This has been like really an intense conversation. I need a nice cup of Dr. Mindy's coffee. Maybe you'll go brew one for me right now. What I will do is put up some links on the blog of, I mean, we've got this tons of stuff out there. We'll put up a few so we can catch up with this in a year and a half when we come back and watch the sequel to Don't Look Up. I'm not sure what that's going to be like, but we'll have some links up there. That'll be on the blog. It's at massclimateaction.org www.climatechange.org/blog. If you are a person who saw this movie but don't really have well-formed opinions about climate change, send us your hot take. Let us know. We'll interview you. We can do that now with Zoom and stuff. So please send an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what you think. You're listening directly, you're probably listening to this on your smartphone using Stitcher or one of the modern podcast distribution apps. Please ask all of your friends to do the same thing. This is usually the point in the show where I say, we thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. But D.R., we have you here in the flesh tonight. So thank you for all of your continuing effort. We value it. It's very useful. We hope you can come back again sometime soon. So
Thanks.
And we will close the way we always close it, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. And because of that, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon that protects environmental justice communities. So I want to thank you all of the panel for being here tonight. It's been a fascinating discussion. I really enjoyed it. And I want to thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Want to thanks everyone for listening. Talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.